This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents The Metamorphosis, a new translation by Susan Bernofsky, written by Franz Kafka and Susan Bernofsky, translator, performed by Eduardo Ballerini, with an introduction performed by Victor Bavine and an afterword performed by Krista Lewis.
Introduction. The Beetle and the Fly, David Cronenberg. I woke up one morning recently to discover that I was a 70-year-old man. Is this different from what happened to Gregor Samsa in The Metamorphosis? He wakes up to find that he's become a near-human-sized beetle, probably of the scarab family if his household's charwoman is to be believed, and not a particularly robust specimen at that. Our reactions, mine and Gregor's, are very similar. We are confused and bemused and think that it's a momentary delusion that will soon dissipate, leaving our lives to continue as they were. What could the source of these twin transformations possibly be? Certainly, you can see a birthday coming from many miles away, and it should not be a shock or a surprise when it happens. And as any well-meaning friend will tell you, 70 is just a number. What impact can that number really have on an actual, unique, physical human life? In the case of Gregor, a young traveling salesman spending a night at home in his family's apartment in Prague, awakening into a strange human-insect hybrid existence is, to say the obvious, a surprise he did not see coming, and the reaction of his household, mother, father, sister, maid, cook, is to recoil in benumbed horror, as one would expect, and not one member of his family feels compelled to console the creature by, for example, pointing out that a beetle is also a living thing. And turning into one might, for a mediocre human living a humdrum life, be an exhilarating and elevating experience. And so what's the problem? This imagined consolation could not, in any case, take place within the structure of the story, because Gregor can understand human speech, but cannot be understood when he tries to speak. And so his family never think to approach him as a creature with human intelligence. It must be noted, though, that in their bourgeois banality, they somehow accept that this creature is, in some unnameable way, their Gregor. It never occurs to them that, for example, a giant beetle has eaten Gregor. They don't have the imagination, and he very quickly becomes not much more than a housekeeping problem. His transformation seals him within himself as surely as if he had suffered a total paralysis. These two scenarios, mine and Gregor's, seem so different. One might ask why I even bother to compare them. The source of the transformation is the same, I argue. We have both awakened to a forced awareness of what we really are, and that awareness is profound and irreversible. In each case, the delusion soon proves to be a new, mandatory reality, and life does not continue as it did. Is Gregor's transformation a death sentence, or in some way a fatal diagnosis? Why does the beetle Gregor not survive? Is it his human brain, depressed and sad and melancholy, that betrays the insect's basic sturdiness? Is it the brain that defeats the bug's urge to survive, even to eat? What's wrong with that beetle? Beetles, the order of insect called Coleoptera, which means sheathed wing. Though Gregor never seems to discover his own wings, which are presumably hiding under his hard wing casings, are notably hardy and well adapted for survival. There are more species of beetle than any other order on Earth. Well, we learn that Gregor has bad lungs. They are none too reliable. And so the Gregor beetle has bad lungs as well, or at least the insect equivalent, and perhaps that really is his fatal diagnosis. Or perhaps it's his growing inability to eat that kills him, as it did Kafka, who ultimately coughed up blood and died of starvation caused by laryngeal tuberculosis at the age of 40. What about me? Is my 70th birthday a death sentence? Of course, yes it is, and in some ways it has sealed me within myself as surely as if I had suffered a total paralysis. And this revelation is the function of the bed, and of dreaming in the bed, the mortar in which the minutiae of everyday life are crushed, ground up, and mixed with memory and desire and dread. Gregor awakes from troubled dreams which are never directly described by Kafka. Did Gregor dream that he was an insect, then awake to find that he was one? What in the world has happened to me, he thought. It was no dream, says Kafka, referring to Gregor's new physical form. but it's not clear that his troubled dreams were anticipatory insect dreams. In the movie I co-wrote and directed of George Langeland's short story, The Fly, I have our hero, Seth Brundle, played by Jeff Goldblum, say, while deep in the throes of his transformation into a hideous fly-human hybrid, "I'm an insect who dreamt he was a man and loved it, but now the dream is over and the insect is awake." He is warning his former lover that he is now a danger to her, a creature with no compassion and no empathy. He has shed his humanity like the shell of a cicada nymph, and what has emerged is no longer human. He is also suggesting that to be a human, a self-aware consciousness, is a dream that cannot last, an illusion. Gregor, too, has trouble clinging to what is left of his humanity, and as his family begins to feel that this thing in Gregor's room is no longer Gregor, he begins to feel the same way. But unlike Brundle's fly self, Gregor's beetle is no threat to anyone but himself, and starves and fades away like an afterthought as his family revels in their freedom from the shameful, embarrassing burden that he has become. When The Fly was released in 1986, there was much conjecture that the disease that Brundle had brought on himself was a metaphor for AIDS. Certainly, I understood this. AIDS was on everybody's mind as the vast scope of the disease was gradually being revealed. But for me, Brundle's disease was more fundamental. In an artificially accelerated manner, he was aging. He was a consciousness that was aware that it was a body that was mortal. And with acute awareness and humor, participated in that inevitable transformation that all of us face, if only we live long enough. Unlike the passive and helpful but anonymous Gregor, Brundle was a star in the firmament of science, and it was a bold and reckless experiment in transmitting matter through space, his DNA mixes with that of an errant fly, that caused his predicament. Langeland's story, first published in Playboy magazine in 1957, falls firmly within the genre of science fiction, with all the mechanics and reasonings of its scientist hero carefully, if fancifully, constructed. To use telephone booths are involved. Kafka's story, of course, is not science fiction. It does not provoke discussion regarding technology and the hubris of scientific investigation, or the use of scientific research for military purposes. Without sci-fi trappings of any kind, The Metamorphosis forces us to think in terms of analogy, of reflexive interpretation, though it is revealing that none of the characters in the story, including Gregor, ever does think that way. There is no meditation on a family secret or sin that might have induced such a monstrous reprisal by God or the fates, no search for meaning even on the most basic existential plane. The bizarre event is dealt with in a perfunctory, petty, materialistic way, and it arouses the narrowest range of emotional response imaginable, almost immediately assuming the tone of an unfortunate natural family occurrence with which one must reluctantly contend. Stories of magical transformations have always been part of humanity's narrative canon. They articulate that universal sense of empathy for all life forms that we feel. They express that desire for transcendence that every religion also expresses. They prompt us to wonder if transformation into another living creature would be a proof of the possibility of reincarnation and some sort of afterlife, and is thus, however hideous or disastrous the narrative, a religious and hopeful concept. Certainly, my Brundlefly goes through moments of manic strength and power, convinced that he has combined the best components of human and insect to become a super being, refusing to see his personal evolution as anything but a victory, even as he begins to shed his human body parts, which he carefully stores in a medicine cabinet he calls the Brundle Museum of Natural History. There is none of this in The Metamorphosis. The Samsa beetle is barely aware that he is a hybrid, though he takes small hybrid pleasures where he can find them, whether it's hanging from the ceiling or scuttling through the mess and dirt of his room, beetle pleasure, or listening to the music that his sister plays on her violin, human pleasure. But the Samsa family is the Samsa beetle's context in his cage, and his subservience to the needs of his family, both before and after his transformation, extends ultimately to his realization that it would be more convenient for them if he just disappeared. It would be an expression of his love for them, in fact. And so he does just that by quietly dying. The Samsa beetle's short life, fantastical though it is played out on the level of the resolutely mundane and the functional, and fails to provoke in the story's characters any hint of philosophy, meditation, or profound reflection. How similar would the story be then, if on that fateful morning, the Sumsa family found in the room of their son, not a young, vibrant traveling salesman who was supporting them by his unselfish and endless labor, but a shuffling, half-blind, barely ambulatory 89-year-old man using insect-like canes, a man who mumbles incoherently and has soiled his trousers and out of the shadow land of his dementia projects anger and induces guilt. If, when Gregor Sumsa woke up one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed right there in his bed into a demented, disabled, demanding old man. His family is horrified, but somehow recognize him as their own Gregor, albeit transformed. Eventually, though, as in the beetle variant of the story, they decide that he is no longer their Gregor, and that it would be a blessing for him to disappear. When I went on my publicity tour for The Fly, I was often asked what insect I would want to be if I underwent an entomological transformation. My answers varied depending on my mood, though I had a fondness for the dragonfly, not only for its spectacular flying, but also for the novelty of its ferocious underwater nymphal stage with its deadly extendable underslung jaw. I also thought that mating in the air might be pleasant. "Would that be your soul, then, this dragonfly flying heavenward?" came one response. "Is that not really what you're looking for?" "No, not really," I said. "I'd just be a simple dragonfly, and then, if I managed to avoid being eaten by a bird or a frog, I would mate. And as summer ended, I would die."
1. When Gregor Sumsa woke one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself transformed right there in his bed into some sort of monstrous insect. He was lying on his back, which was hard, like a carapace, and when he raised his head a little, he saw his curved brown belly segmented by rigid arches, atop which the blanket, already slipping, was just barely managing to cling. His many legs, pitifully thin compared to the rest of him, waved helplessly before his eyes. "What in the world has happened to me?" he thought. It was no dream. His room, a proper human room, if admittedly rather too small, lay peacefully between the four familiar walls. Above the table, where an unpacked collection of cloth samples was arranged, Sumsa was a traveling salesman, hung the picture he had recently clipped from a glossy magazine and placed in an attractive gilt frame. This picture showed a lady in a fur hat and fur boa who sat erect, holding out to the viewer a heavy fur muff in which her entire forearm had vanished. Gregor's gaze then shifted to the window, where the bleak weather, raindrops could be heard striking the metal sill, made him feel quite melancholy. "What if I just go back to sleep for a little while and forget all this foolishness?" he thought. But this proved utterly impossible, for it was his habit to sleep on his right side, and in his present state he was unable to assume this position. No matter how forcefully he thrust himself onto his side, he kept rolling back. Perhaps 100 times he attempted it, closing his eyes so as not to have to see those struggling legs, and relented only when he began to feel a faint, dull ache in his side, unlike anything he'd ever felt before. "Good Lord," he thought, "what an exhausting profession I've chosen. Day in and day out on the road. Work like this is far more unsettling than business conducted at home. And then I have the agony of traveling itself to contend with, worrying about train connections, the irregular, unpalatable meals, and human intercourse that is constantly changing, never developing the least constancy or warmth. Devil take it all." He felt a faint itch high up in his belly. Still on his back, he laboriously edged himself over to the bedpost so he could raise his head more easily. Identified the site of the itch. A cluster of tiny white dots he was unable to judge, and wanted to probe the spot with a leg, but drew it back again at once, for the touch sent cold shivers rippling through him. He slid back into his earlier position. "All this early rising," he thought. "It's enough to make one soft in the head. Human beings need their sleep. Other traveling salesmen live like harem girls. When I go back to the boarding house, for example, to copy out the morning's commissions, why, these gentlemen may still be sitting at breakfast. I'd like to see my boss's face if I tried that sometime. He'd can me on the spot. Although, who knows? Maybe that would be the best thing for me.
If I didn't have to hold back for my parents' sake, I'd have given notice long ago. I'd have marched right up to him and given him a piece of my mind. He'd have fallen right off his desk. And what an odd custom that is, perching high up atop one's elevated desk, and from this considerable height addressing one's employee down below, especially as the latter is obliged to stand quite close because his boss is hard of hearing. Well, all hope is not yet lost. As soon as I've saved up enough money to pay back what my parents owe him, another 5 or 6 years ought to be enough, I'll most definitely do just that. This will be the great parting of ways. For the time being, though, I've got to get up. My train leaves at 5. And he glanced over at the alarm clock ticking away atop the wardrobe. Heavenly Father, he thought. It was 6:30, and the clock's hands kept shifting calmly forward. In fact, the half hour had already passed. It was getting on toward 6:45. Could the alarm have failed to ring? Even from the bed, one could see it was properly set for 4 o'clock. It must have rung. Yes, but was it possible to sleep tranquilly through this furniture-shaking racket? Well, his sleep hadn't been exactly tranquil, but no doubt that's why it had been so sound. But what should he do now? The next train was at 7 o'clock. To catch it, he would have to rush like a madman, and his sample case wasn't even packed yet, and he himself felt far from agile or alert. And even if he managed to catch this train, his boss was certain to unleash a thunderstorm of invective upon his head, for the clerk who met the 5 o'clock train had no doubt long since reported Gregor's absence. This clerk was the boss's underling, a creature devoid of backbone and wit. What if he called in sick? But that would be mortifying and also suspicious, since Gregor had never once been ill in all his 5 years of service. No doubt his boss would come calling with the company doctor, would reproach Gregor's parents for their son's laziness, silencing all objections by referring them to this doctor, in whose opinion there existed only healthy individuals unwilling to work. And would the doctor be so terribly wrong in this instance? Aside from a mild drowsiness that was certainly superfluous after so many hours of sleep, Gregor felt perfectly fine. In fact, he was ravenous. While he was considering these matters with the greatest possible speed, yet still without managing to make up his mind to leave the bed, the clock was just striking 6:45, a timid knock came at the door at the head of his bed. Gregor? The voice called. It was his mother. It's 6:45. Didn't you want to catch your train? That gentle voice. Gregor flinched when he heard his own in response. It was unmistakably his old voice. But now it had been infiltrated as if from below by a tortured peeping sound that was impossible to suppress, leaving each word intact, comprehensible, but only for an instant before so completely annihilating it as it continued to reverberate that a person could not tell for sure whether his ears were deceiving him. Gregor had meant to give a proper response explaining everything, but under the circumstances he limited himself to saying, "Yes, thank you, Mother, I'm just getting up." Because of the wooden door, the change in Gregor's voice appeared not to be noticeable from the other side, for his mother was reassured by his response and shuffled off. But their brief conversation had alerted the other family members that Gregor was unexpectedly still at home, and already his father was knocking at one of the room's side doors, softly but with his fist. "Gregor, Gregor," he called. "What's the problem?" And after a short while he repeated his question in a deeper register. "Gregor! Gregor!" Meanwhile, at the other side door came his sister's faint lament. "Gregor, are you unwell? Do you need anything?"
"Just a second,"
Gregor answered in both directions at once, making an effort, by enunciating as clearly as possible and inserting long pauses between the individual words, to remove anything conspicuous from his voice. And in fact, his father returned to his breakfast. But his sister whispered, "Gregor, open the door, I implore you." But Gregor had no intention of opening the door. He praised the cautious habit he had acquired while traveling of locking all his doors at night, even at home. First, he would get up calmly and undisturbed. He would get dressed and, above all, have breakfast, and only then would he consider his next steps. for all these supine contemplations he suddenly realized would yield no useful results. He recalled often having felt mild aches and pains in bed, caused perhaps by lying in an awkward position, and this pain had then proven to be a figment of his imagination the moment he got up. He was curious to see how this morning's imaginings would gradually fade. The change in his voice was nothing more than the harbinger of a proper head cold, an occupational hazard among traveling salesmen. This he doubted not in the least. It was simple enough to rid himself of the blanket. He needed only puff himself up a bit, and it fell right off. But the rest proved difficult, not least because he was so exceedingly wide. He would have needed arms and hands to prop himself up. But instead all he had were these many little legs, variously in motion, that he was unable to control. If he tried to bend one leg, it would be the first to straighten. And when he finally succeeded in getting one leg to do his bidding, all the others went flailing about in an unnerving frenzy. "Enough of this lying about uselessly in bed," Gregor said to himself. At first he tried to maneuver the lower part of his body out of the bed. But this lower part, which, by the way, he had not yet seen and couldn't properly imagine, proved too unwieldy. It all went so slowly. And when at last, half mad with impatience, he thrust himself recklessly forward with all his strength, it was in the wrong direction, and he slammed against the lower bedpost. The throbbing pain he felt instructed him that for now at least, the lower part of his body was perhaps the most sensitive. So he decided to try leading instead with his upper body, and carefully twisted his head toward the edge of the bed. This was easily accomplished, and in the end, despite his width and weight, the mass of his body slowly followed the turning of his head. But once his head was dangling in mid-air outside the bed, he was afraid to keep shifting forward like this, since if eventually he had to let himself fall in this position, it would be practically a miracle if his head escaped injury. And right now, he had to keep his wits about him at all costs, even if it meant staying where he was. But when, sighing after redoubled efforts, he found himself lying there as before, watching his little legs engaged in their struggles, perhaps more flailingly now, and seeing no possible way to bring calm or order to this chaos, he told himself once more that he could not possibly remain lying here any longer, and that the most sensible thing would be to sacrifice anything and everything as long as there remained even the slightest hope of liberating himself from the bed. Simultaneously, though, he continued to remind himself that calm consideration, indeed the calmest consideration, was far preferable to resolution seized on in despair. At such moments he fixed his eyes as sharply as possible on the window, but regrettably the view of the morning fog, which veiled even the far side of the narrow street, offered little by way of optimism and good spirits. 7 o'clock already, he said to himself as the clock struck once more. Already 7, and still such dense fog. And for a little while he lay there quietly, his breathing shallow in the expectation, perhaps, that this perfect silence might possibly restore the real and ordinary state of things. Then he said to himself, "Before it strikes 7:15, I must absolutely have gotten myself completely out of bed. Besides, by then someone will have come from the office to inquire after me, as the office opens before 7. And he now set himself to rocking his body out of the bed as evenly as possible along his entire length. If he allowed himself to fall from the bed like this, his head, which he intended to lift up cleanly as he fell, would in all likelihood remain unharmed. His back seemed to be hard. Surely it would sustain no damage as he fell to the rug. His greatest concern was what to do about the loud crash that would clearly result, no doubt calling forth not terror, perhaps, but certainly alarm behind each door. Nonetheless, it would have to be ventured. By the time Gregor was already protruding halfway out of bed, this new method was more a game than a struggle. All he had to do was keep rocking sideways a little at a time. It occurred to him how simple things would be if only someone came to his aid. 2 strong individuals, he was thinking of his father and the maidservant, would suffice. All they'd have to do was slip their arms beneath his curved back to scoop him out of bed, then crouch down with their burden and wait patiently for him to flip himself over onto the floor, where he hoped those tiny legs of his would take on some meaning. But even aside from the fact that the doors were locked, should he really call for help? Despite his distress, he couldn't help smiling at the thought. Already he'd reached the point where the vigorous rocking motion was making it almost impossible for him to keep his balance, and soon he would have to make up his mind and take the plunge, for a quarter after 7 was only 5 minutes away, when the front doorbell rang. "It's someone from the office," he said to himself, and nearly froze while his little legs went on scrabbling all the more frenetically. For a moment, all was still. "They won't answer," Gregor said to himself, caught up in some deluded hope. But then, of course, as always, the maid strode resolutely to the door and opened it. Gregor needed only hear the visitor's first words of greeting to know who it was. The general manager himself. Why, oh why, was Gregor condemned to serve in a firm where even the most negligible falling short was enough to arouse the greatest possible suspicion? Was every last one of the firm's employees a scoundrel? Was there not a single loyal, devoted soul among them who would be driven mad by pangs of conscience should he fail to make the best possible use of even just a few morning hours for his employer's benefit, such that his guilt would render him virtually incapable of rising from his bed? Would it really not have sufficed to send an apprentice to inquire, if indeed such inquiries were necessary at all? Did the general manager have to come in person? And was it necessary to demonstrate to the entire innocent family that the investigation of this suspicious matter could be entrusted only to the general manager's sharp intellect? And more because of the agitation aroused in Gregor by this train of thought than because of some proper resolution on his part, he swung himself out of bed with all his might. There was a loud thud. You couldn't really call it a crash. The rug cushioned the impact a little, and since his back was more elastic than he'd thought, the resulting sound was muffled and not so obvious. But he hadn't managed to hold his head up carefully enough and had bumped it. He turned it this way and that, pressing it against the rug in his vexation and pain. "Something just fell in there," the general manager now said in the room on the left. Gregor tried to imagine whether anything like what he was now experiencing could ever befall the general manager. The possibility must certainly be admitted. But as if brusquely dismissing the question, the manager now took a few purposeful steps in the next room, making his patent leather boots creak. From the room on the right came the whisper of Gregor's sister informing him, "Gregor, the general manager is here." "I know," Gregor murmured, but he didn't dare raise his voice high enough for his sister to hear. "Gregor," his father now said from the room on the left, "the general manager has come to inquire why you failed to depart by the early train. We don't know what to tell him. Besides, he'd like to have a word with you in person, so please open the door. I'm sure he'll be kind enough not to take offense at the untidiness of your room." "Good morning, Herr Samsa," the general manager now cried out in a friendly tone. "He isn't well," Gregor's mother said to the general manager, while his father was still having his say beside the door. "Not well at all. Take my word for it, sir. Why else would Gregor miss his train? The office is the only thing that boy ever thinks of. It really bothers me that he never goes out in the evening. He's been back in the city an entire week now, but he spent every last evening at home. He just sits at the table with us, quietly reading the newspaper, or else studies the timetables. Even just doing woodworking projects seems to entertain him. He carved a little picture frame, for example, did it in 2 or 3 evenings with his fret saw. You'll be amazed how pretty it is. It's hanging there in his room. You'll see it in a minute when Gregor opens the door. Oh, and I'm so glad you paid us a visit, sir. On our own, we'd never have managed to persuade Gregor to open up. He's so stubborn, and surely he isn't well, even though he denied it this morning." "Be right there," Gregor said, not moving, so as not to miss a single word of their conversation. "No other explanation, madam, is conceivable to me," the general manager said. "Let us hope it is nothing grave. Though on the other hand, I would note that as businessmen, fortunately or unfortunately, as one will, we are very often obliged to suppress indispositions out of consideration for the firm."
So are you ready to let the general manager in?
Gregor's impatient father asked, knocking again at the door.
No,
Gregor responded. In the left-hand room, horrified silence, while in the room on the right, Gregor's sister began to sob. Why didn't his sister go to join the others? She must have gotten out of bed and not yet begun to dress. And why was she crying? Because he wasn't getting up and opening his door to the general manager? Because he was in danger of losing his position? And because his boss would then start hounding his parents once more over their ancient debt? For the time being, all such worries were assuredly unnecessary. Gregor was still here, and abandoning his family was the farthest thing from his thoughts. At the moment, to be sure, he was lying on the rug, and no one familiar with his current state would seriously expect him to let the general manager in. But surely he wouldn't be sent packing just like that because of so trivial an act of discourtesy, for which it would be simple enough to find an appropriate excuse later on. And it seemed to Gregor it would be far more sensible to just leave him in peace, rather than disturbing him with all this weeping and cajoling. But the others were distressed by the uncertainty of it all. Their behavior was understandable.
Herr Samsa,
the general manager now called out, raising his voice. What has come over you? You barricade yourself in your room. You reply to queries only with yes and no. You cause your parents onerous, unnecessary worries. And you are neglecting, let me permit myself to note, your professional responsibilities in a truly unprecedented manner. I speak here in the name of your parents as well as your employer, and in all seriousness must ask you for a clear and immediate explanation. I am astonished, utterly astonished. I have always known you as a calm, sensible person, and now it seems you've begun to permit yourself the most whimsical extravagances. To be sure, the boss did suggest one possible explanation for your absence this morning. It concerns the cash payments recently entrusted to your care. And truthfully, I all but gave him my word of honor that this explanation could not be correct. But confronted here with your incomprehensible obstinacy, I find myself losing any desire I might have had to come to your defense. And your position is anything but secure. It was originally my intention to discuss all this with you in a private conversation, but since you compel me to waste my time here, I do not know why your esteemed parents should not hear of it as well. In short, your productivity of late has been highly unsatisfactory. Admittedly, this is not the best season for drumming up business, we do acknowledge this, but a season in which no business at all is drummed up is something that does not, and indeed may not, exist, Herr Samsa.
But sir,
Gregor cried out, beside himself and forgetting all else in his agitation.
I shall open the door at once, this very instant. A slight indisposition, a fit of dizziness, kept me from getting up. Even now I'm still in bed. But already I am feeling very much refreshed. Here, I'm getting up. Just a moment's patience. It's a bit more difficult than I thought. But already I'm feeling quite fine. How odd the way such a thing can suddenly come over one. Yesterday evening I felt perfectly all right. My parents can attest to this. Or rather, I did, in fact, feel a mild foreboding yesterday evening already. Surely it was noticeable to anyone looking at me. Why didn't I send word to the office? But we always just assume we'll be able to overcome these illnesses without staying home.
Sir, do be gentle with my parents. The allegations you make are unfounded, and no one has ever mentioned anything of the sort to me. Perhaps you haven't yet looked over the most recent commissions I sent in. In any case, I'll be back on the road in time for the 8 o'clock train. These additional hours of rest have fortified me. Please do not allow me to detain you any longer, sir. I shall be at the office myself in no time. Do be so good as to say I'm on my way and give my regards to the boss. And while Gregor was hastily blurting out all of this, scarcely knowing what he said, he edged closer to the wardrobe with minimal effort, no doubt thanks to the practice he had already acquired while still in bed. And now he did his best to haul himself upright. Indeed, he really did want to open the door, to show himself and speak with the general manager. He was eager to learn what the others, who were so anxious to see him, would say when they finally laid eyes on him. If they recoiled in horror, Gregor could surrender all responsibility and rest easy. But if they accepted it all calmly, that meant he too had no reason to get himself worked up. And if he hurried, he could still make it to the station by 8. At first he couldn't get a grip on the wardrobe's smooth surface, but finally he gave a great heave
and found himself standing upright. He no longer paid any heed to the pain in his lower body, ache as it might. Now he let himself drop against the back of a nearby chair, clinging to its edges with his little legs. And having thus attained control over himself, he fell silent. For now he could listen to the general manager.
"Did you understand a single word?"
the manager was asking Gregor's parents.
"Surely he isn't trying to make fools of us."
"For heaven's sake," Gregor's mother cried, already weeping. "He might be gravely ill, and here we are tormenting him."
"Greta, Greta,"
she cried out.
"Mother?"
Gregor's sister called from the other side. They were communicating through Gregor's room.
"You must go for the doctor at once. Gregor is ill. Quick, fetch the doctor. Did you hear him speaking just now?"
"That was an animal's voice,"
the general manager said, speaking in noticeably subdued tones compared to the cries of Gregor's mother.
"Anna! Anna!"
the father shouted into the kitchen through the vestibule, clapping his hands.
"Run and fetch a locksmith, hurry!"
And already the two girls were racing through the vestibule, their skirts rustling. How had Gregor's sister possibly gotten dressed so quickly? And flung open the front door. There was no sound of the door closing again. No doubt they had left it standing open, as one sees with apartments in which a great calamity has occurred. But Gregor was far less troubled now. Even though the others were no longer able to understand his words, though they had seemed to him clear enough, clearer than in the past, perhaps because his ear had grown accustomed to their sound, they were now convinced that things were not right with him and were prepared to offer help. The confidence and conviction with which these first arrangements had been made comforted him. He felt drawn once more into the circle of humankind, and was expecting both the doctor and the locksmith, without properly differentiating between the two, to perform magnificent, astounding feats. So as to have as intelligible a voice as possible for the crucial discussions that lay ahead, he cleared his throat a little, making an effort to do this as discreetly as possible, since even this sound might differ from human throat-clearing, which he no longer trusted himself to judge. In the next room, meanwhile, all was quiet. Perhaps his parents sat whispering at the table with the general manager, or perhaps all of them were leaning against the door listening. Gregor slowly pushed himself over to the door using the armchair, then let go and allowed himself to fall against the door, propping himself upright. The pads of his little legs turned out to be slightly sticky, and there he rested briefly from his exertions. Then he set about turning the key in the lock using his mouth. Unfortunately, it seemed he had no real teeth, so how was he supposed to grasp the key? But his jaws turned out to be surprisingly strong, and with their help, he actually succeeded in causing the key to move, paying no heed to the fact that he was no doubt injuring himself in the process, for a brown fluid ran out of his mouth and down the key, dripping onto the floor.
"Listen to that," the general manager said in the next room. "He's turning the key in the lock."
Gregor found these words most encouraging, but all of them should have been cheering him on, including his father and mother.
"Come on, Gregor,"
they should have shouted.
"Just keep at it. Keep working on that lock."
And now, imagining all of them following his efforts with great suspense, he bit down on the key uncomprehendingly, with all the force he could muster. With each revolution of the key, he danced about the lock, holding himself upright, using only his mouth and, as needed, either clinging to the key or using the entire weight of his body to press it down. The brighter sound of the lock finally springing open positively revived him. Sighing in relief, he said to himself, "I guess I didn't need the locksmith after all." And he laid his head upon the handle of the door to press it open. But he remained hidden from view as the door swung toward him, even after it was wide open. To be seen, he had to work his way slowly around one of the wings of the double door, a delicate operation if he wanted to avoid plopping down awkwardly on his back before he'd even entered the room. He was still occupied with this difficult maneuver and had no leisure to attend to anything else, when he heard the general manager utter a loud, "Oh!" It sounded like wind howling. And now he saw him, too. Saw how the general manager, who was standing closest to the door, pressed his hand to his open mouth, slowly retreating,
as though being driven back by an invisible, steady force. Gregor's mother, who despite the general manager's presence, stood with her hair still undone from the night, wildly bristling, first looked over at his father, her hands clasped, then took two steps in Gregor's direction, before falling down in the midst of all her billowing skirts, her face vanishing completely where it sank to her bosom. Gregor's father clenched his fist with a hostile grimace, as if he intended to thrust Gregor back into his room, then glanced uncertainly about the living room, shaded his eyes with his hands, and wept until his mighty chest shook. Gregor made no move to enter the room. Instead, he leaned from the inside against the wing of the door that was bolted fast, so that only half his body and the head inclined sideways above it could be seen as he peered across at the others. Meanwhile, it had grown much lighter out. On the far side of the street, a section of the infinitely long, dark gray building opposite, a hospital, came into view with its regular windows punched into the facade. Rain was still falling, but only in large drops that were separately visible and seemed to have been hurled one by one to the ground. An inordinate number of breakfast dishes crowded the table, for Gregor's father considered breakfast the most important meal of the day and would drag it out for hours reading various newspapers. Straight ahead, on the opposite wall, hung a photograph of Gregor from his time in the military, showing him as a second lieutenant, whose carefree smile as he rested his hand on his dagger commanded respect for his bearing and his uniform. The door to the vestibule was open, and since the front door was open as well, one could see all the way out to the landing and the head of the stairs leading down. "Well," Gregor said, quite conscious of the fact that he was the only one who had retained his composure, "I shall get dressed at once, pack up my samples, and be on my way. As for the rest of you, are you prepared to let me do so?" "You can see, sir," he said, addressing the general manager, "I am not obstinate, nor a shirker. Traveling is burdensome, but without it I could not live. Where are you going now, sir? To the office, yes? Will you report all these things truthfully? A person can be incapable of working at the moment, but this is precisely the right time to recall his earlier accomplishments, and consider that he will later, once the hindrance has been overcome, work all the more industriously and with greater focus. I am so dreadfully indebted to the boss. Surely you're aware of this. On the other hand, I have my parents and sister to think of. Truly, I am in a bind, but I shall work my way out of it. Don't make things more difficult for me than they already are. Take my side at the office. No one loves us drummers, I know. Everyone thinks the salesmen rake in a king's ransom while enjoying life's pleasures, and there's never any particular cause to reconsider this prejudice. But you, sir, have a far better grasp of the general circumstances than the rest of the staff. Better even, if I may speak confidentially, than the boss himself, who in his role as businessman can easily err in his opinion to an employee's disadvantage. And you no doubt know quite well that a drummer who spends almost the entire year away from the office can easily become the victim of gossip, happenstance, and groundless complaints against which he cannot possibly defend himself, as he usually never even learns of them, or only when he has completed one of his journeys, exhausted, and then back at home is forced to observe the dire physical effects of causes that can no longer be identified. Please, sir, do not leave without saying something to show you agree with me, at least to some small extent. But the general manager had already turned away as soon as Gregor began to speak, and merely glanced back at him over a hunched shoulder, his mouth contorted. And during Gregor's speech, he did not stand still for a moment, but instead continued to retreat, not letting Gregor out of his sight, in the direction of the door, but only gradually, as though it were secretly prohibited to exit this room. Already he was in the vestibule, and to judge by the abrupt motion with which he withdrew his foot from the living room for the last time, one might have supposed he'd just burned it. Having reached the vestibule, however, he stretched out his right hand, gesturing broadly in the direction of the stairs, as if some all but supernatural salvation awaited him there. Gregor realized he could not possibly allow the general manager to depart in his present frame of mind if his own position at the firm was not to be put in the gravest jeopardy. His parents didn't fully comprehend his situation. Over these long years, they had formed the conviction that Gregor was provided for in this office for life. And besides, they were so preoccupied with their present worries that they were bereft of all foresight. But Gregor had this foresight. The general manager would have to be detained, reasoned with, convinced, and finally won over. After all, Gregor's future, and that of his family, depended on it. If only his sister were here. She was clever. She had already begun to weep while Gregor was still lying quietly on his back. And surely the general manager, ever the ladies' man, would have let himself be assuaged by her. She would have closed the front door of the apartment and talked him out of his fear in the vestibule. But his sister was not there. So Gregor himself would have to act. And without stopping to consider that he was not yet familiar with his current abilities with respect to locomotion, nor even taking into account the fact that this last speech of his had quite possibly, indeed probably, eluded comprehension, he let go of the door, forced his way through the opening, meant to walk over to where the general manager, already out on the landing, was foolishly clutching at the banister with both hands. But right away, groping in vain for something to catch hold of, he fell with a faint shriek upon his many little legs. No sooner had this occurred than he felt, for the first time all morning, a sense of physical well-being. His legs had solid ground beneath them. They obeyed his will perfectly, as he noted to his delight. They even strove to bear him wherever he wished, and already it seemed to him he would soon be delivered from all his sufferings. But as he lay there on the floor directly in front of his mother and not far from her, swaying with mobility held in check, she suddenly leapt up, rapt as she had appeared within her own contemplations, leapt high up into the air, her arms thrust wide, fingers spread, crying out, "Help me! For God's sake, help!" Her head cocked at an angle, as if to see Gregor better, but then, contradicting this, she senselessly retreated. But she had forgotten the table set for breakfast just behind her, sat down hurriedly upon it as soon as she reached it, as if absent-mindedly, and didn't seem to notice that the big overturned coffee pot beside her was pouring a thick stream of coffee on the rug. "Mother, mother," Gregor said softly, gazing up at her. For a moment he had forgotten all about the general manager. On the other hand, he could not restrain himself when he beheld this flowing coffee, from snapping his jaws several times. At this, the mother gave another shriek and fled from the table into the arms of Gregor's father as he rushed to her aid. But Gregor had no time for his parents now. The general manager was already on the stairs. His chin propped on the banister, he looked back on the scene one last time. Gregor was just preparing to dash after him to be sure of catching up with him. But the manager must have sensed something, for he leapt down several steps at once and vanished. And the cry of horror he gave as he fled resounded through the stairwell. Unfortunately, the manager's flight now appeared to utterly discombobulate Gregor's father, who up till then had been relatively composed, for instead of running after the manager himself, or at least not hindering Gregor in his own pursuit, he seized the manager's walking stick in one hand. It had been left lying on an armchair along with his overcoat and hat. With the other, took up a large newspaper from the table and set about driving Gregor back into his room with a great stamping of feet, brandishing both newspaper and stick. All Gregor's entreaties were in vain, nor were they even understood, for as submissively as he might swivel his head, his father only stamped his feet all the more ferociously. Across the room, his mother had flung open a window despite the chilly weather, and leaning out, she pressed her face into her hands far outside the window frame. Between street and stairwell, a powerful draft arose. The window curtains flew into the air. The newspapers on the table rustled, and a few pages scudded across the floor. Inexorably, Gregor's father drove him backward, uttering hissing sounds like a wild man. But Gregor had no practice at all in reverse locomotion, and his progress was very slow. If only he'd been permitted to turn around, he'd have been back in his room at once. But he was afraid of provoking his father's fury with this time-consuming maneuver, and at any moment a fatal blow from the stick in his father's hand might come crashing down on his back or head. In the end, though, he had no alternative. Horrified, he realized he was incapable of controlling his direction, and so he began, with constant anxious glances back at his father, to turn around as quickly as he could, which, in fact, was rather slowly. Perhaps his father discerned his good intentions, for he did not hinder him in this operation, but instead even guided his rotation here and there from a distance, using the tip of his stick. If only his father were not making that unbearable hissing noise! It made Gregor lose his head completely. He had already turned almost all the way around when, still with this hissing in his ear, he became confused and started turning back in the wrong direction. But when finally he succeeded in positioning his head in front of the doorway, it turned out that his body was too wide to fit through the opening. And of course, in his father's current state, it could not possibly have occurred to him to open the door's other wing to create an adequate passage. He was fixated on the notion that Gregor must disappear into his room as quickly as possible. Never would he have tolerated the complicated preparations necessary for Gregor to prop himself up so as possibly to pass through the door in an upright position. Instead, as though there were no obstacle at all, he now drove Gregor before him, raising a great din. What Gregor heard at his back no longer resembled the voice of merely a single father. It was do or die, and Gregor thrust himself, come what would, into the doorway. One side of his body tilted up, rising at an angle as he pressed forward, scraping his one flank raw and leaving ugly stains behind on the white door, and soon he was wedged tight, unable to move on his own. On one side, his little legs dangled, trembling in midair, while on the other they were crushed painfully beneath him. Then his father administered a powerful shove from behind, a genuinely liberating thrust that sent him flying, bleeding profusely into the far reaches of his room. The door was banged shut with the stick, and then at last, all was still. 2. Only as dusk was falling did Gregor wake from his heavy, faint-like sleep. He probably wouldn't have slept much longer even without a disturbance, for he felt sufficiently rested and restored. But it seemed to him he had been woken by a fleeting step and the careful shutting of the door to the vestibule. The pallid gleam of the electric street lamps touched the ceiling here and there and the upper edges of the furniture, but down where Gregor lay, all was dark. Slowly, groping awkwardly with his feelers, which he was only now learning to appreciate, he dragged himself toward the door, wanting to see what had happened. His left side felt like one long, unpleasantly contracting scar, and he was forced to limp outright on his two rows of legs. One of these diminutive legs, incidentally, had suffered grievous injuries in the course of the morning's events. It was almost miraculous only one had been injured, and now trailed lifelessly behind him. Not until he reached the door did he realize what in fact had lured him there. It was the smell of something edible. There stood a bowl filled with sweet milk in which little pieces of white bread were floating. He almost laughed with delight, for his hunger was now even more powerful than in the morning, and right away he dunked his head in the milk almost up to his eyes. But he quickly drew it out again in disappointment. It wasn't just that eating was difficult thanks to his tender left side, and he couldn't eat at all without his entire body becoming gaspingly involved. But beyond that, even though milk had always been his favorite drink, which is no doubt why his sister had brought him some, now it didn't taste good to him at all. Indeed, it was almost with revulsion that he turned away from the bowl and crept back to the center of the room. In the living room, as Gregor saw through the crack, the gas had been lit. But while usually at this hour his father liked to read aloud from the afternoon paper to Gregor's mother, and sometimes his sister as well, in a dramatic voice, now there was not a sound to be heard. Well, perhaps this customary reading aloud that his sister had often told and written him about had recently fallen out of practice. But even in the other rooms everything was so still, even though the apartment was surely not empty. "What a quiet life my family has been leading," Gregor said to himself, and as he gazed fixedly into the darkness before him, he felt great pride at having been able to give his parents and sister a life like this, in such a beautiful apartment. But what if all this tranquility, all this prosperity and contentment, were now coming to a horrific end? So as not to get lost in such contemplations, Gregor set himself in motion, crawling back and forth across the room. Once in the course of this long evening, one of the side doors was opened a tiny crack and then quickly shut again, and once the other one. Someone must have felt an urge to enter and then been overcome by misgivings. Gregor now stationed himself just in front of the living room door, determined to somehow coax the hesitant visitor inside, or at least find out who it was. But the door did not open again, and Gregor waited in vain. Before, when all the doors were locked, everyone kept trying to come in, and now that he had opened the one door and the others had apparently been opened during the day, no one came, and the keys were sticking in their locks from the outside. It was late at night by the time the light in the living room went out, and now it was easy to ascertain that Gregor's parents and sister had remained awake all this time, for all three of them could clearly be heard departing on tiptoe. Now it was unlikely anyone would come into Gregor's room before morning, so he had plenty of time to ponder how best to reorder his life. But this high, open room in which he was forced to lie flat on the floor distressed him, without his being able to determine the cause. After all, it was his room, which he had been living in for 5 years now, and with a half-unconscious motion, and not without a twinge of shame, he scurried beneath the settee, where even though his back was a bit cramped and he could no longer raise his head, he at once felt right at home, his only regret being that his body was too wide across to be accommodated entirely beneath this piece of furniture. Here he remained the entire night, which he spent by turns dozing, though he was woken again and again by his hunger, and mulling over his worries and indistinct hopes, which, however, all led to the conclusion that for the time being he should behave calmly, and by employing patience and the utmost consideration, assist his family in enduring the inconveniences his current state inevitably forced him to impose on them. Early the next morning already, so early it was almost still night, Gregor had the opportunity to test the strength of these resolutions he had made. For from the vestibule his sister, almost completely clothed, opened his door and cast an anxious glance into the room. She didn't immediately spot him, but when she noticed him beneath the settee, well, goodness, he had to be somewhere. It's not as if he might have flown away. The sight so alarmed her that, unable to control herself, she slammed the door from the outside. But as if regretting this conduct, she opened it again at once and came in, walking on tiptoe as though she were entering the room of a gravely ill patient or even a stranger. Gregor, having slid his head to just beneath the edge of the settee, observed her. Would she see that he had left the milk standing, and not because of a lack of hunger, and would she bring him some other food more to his liking? If she failed to do so of her own accord, he would sooner starve than call this to her attention, though in fact he felt a nearly monstrous urge to scoot out from beneath the settee, throw himself at his sister's feet, and beg her for something good to eat. But his sister immediately remarked with surprise that the bowl was still full, with just a little of its milk spilled on the floor around it, and she picked it up right away, not with her bare hands to be sure, but with a rag, and carried it out of the room. Gregor was exceptionally curious to see what she would bring in its stead, and mulled over various possibilities. But never would he have been able to predict what his sister in her kindness proceeded to do. To gauge his tastes, she brought him an entire assortment of foodstuffs, all spread out on an old newspaper. There were old half-rotten vegetables, bones from the family's supper the night before caked in a congealed white sauce, a few raisins and almonds, a piece of cheese Gregor had declared inedible 2 days before, a dry piece of bread, a slice of buttered bread, and a slice of bread with butter and salt. In addition, she placed beside this feast the bowl that apparently had been reserved for Gregor once and for all. It was now filled with water. And out of delicacy, since she knew Gregor would not eat in front of her, She quickly withdrew and even turned the key in the lock so that Gregor would understand he could make himself at home. Gregor's little legs whirred as he now went to take his meal.